Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you pay to know that your worst nightmare could never come true? What would you pay to watch it happening to somebody else? As fans of horror films can attest, there can be entertainment value, even comfort, in witnessing terrifying acts and life or death struggle, provided it is fictional and happening to another individual. But while others might dismiss scary movies as a shameful pleasure, many film scholars and critics say the genre deserves serious consideration for what it communicates about our greatest fears and about the times we live in. Rick Borland is here to talk about that. He is professor of cinema television at Southern Methodist University, and he has just published a book called The Horror Film, An Introduction. Rick, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What are horror movies about?
Well, at the most basic level, horror movies are about fears. They're about our fears. Some of the, again, as you just said, some of the very worst things that we're afraid of, things that we'd rather not think about, and yet it's inevitable that those fears, large and small, do come up. The analogy between horror films and nightmares is frequent because that does seem to be it's a kind of place that's heavily bound up with our personal psychology, obviously. And it's a way that in a dream, in a nightmare, we're venting and dealing with our own individual issues and problems and fears. But it's a more collective experience, obviously, with the horror film.
Charlie Kaufman's new film, Synecdoche, New York, which comes out, I guess, next week, he has called that a horror film. But that doesn't follow any of the conventions, and so no one else will call it that, although it's about sort of the deepest fears of death and aging and things like that. Can you talk about the conventions that have to exist in order for something to fall into that category?
Well, that's interesting that he would say that, because a lot of movies, I'd say probably in the last 20 years or so, sometimes take on the connotations of the horror film. And I think that really descends from Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960, which at that particular time was not really thought of as a horror film, but just that. But the main element that helps define the horror film is really the Gothic elements that comes from the Gothic literature of the late 18th century. The most important things for Gothicism is the haunted house or the haunted castle, is that location, secrets that deal with the past in some way or another. And frequently the monster, the ghost, is the kind of Gothic monster par excellence, because it's literally this figure from that represents the past. And that's frequently one of the major elements, along with, you know, fear, obviously.
What was it about the past or the supernatural that so appealed to Gothic writers?
Yeah, it's interesting because it took, when Gothicism began, the word Gothic is a synonym for medieval, and that's where, again, the role of architecture is very important in the Gothic form. We don't have any haunted castles in the United States. The country is far too young, so we have the old haunted house. At that particular point in the late 18th century, this is also the famous Age of Enlightenment, in which rationality and science, it seems to be ascendant against traditional, not only religious practices, but much more archaic pagan folk practices and beliefs and so on. And there was this, if you read Voltaire and Jefferson and many other people, they act as if, we've now we're rational. Now we've thought through these issues. We've banished gods and devils alike, and everything now will fall into place. Well, not everyone accepted that argument that strongly, and so both traditional religious practices as well as pagan superstitious beliefs continue to exist very powerfully. And that's really what I think Gothic literature is dealing with, that contrast between the daylight world of the rational and the nighttime world of darkness and fear and irrationality.
You mentioned Psycho, and that was such an interesting movie because we identify not only with the victim of Norman Bates, but suddenly we're in this place where we're worried about Norman getting discovered. That is kind of a terrifying place to find yourself in.
Well, that was the brilliance of Alfred Hitchcock, and especially after World War II, he was very good at manipulating audiences, especially at the very basic level through casting. That here you have Anthony Perkins, who's this good-looking, shy boy next door kind of character, and yet there's a monster in there. And the part of Norman that is Norman, who's the son, who's oppressed by the awful mother, we do feel sympathy for. And it's the contrast between those two within the same figure that makes that character and that performance, I think, so fascinating.
And then you see that again in some ways in The Silence of the Lambs, where we have been told over and over and over again to fear Hannibal Lecter, but we start to trust him. Somehow we don't think he can be as bad as what we've been told until we see it for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that's true. Again, that's another wonderful performance, although there, of course, we are told from the very beginning this guy is bad, and of course we recognize that he is. But this guy is also witty and charming, and even though he's very elitist and condescending, he eventually comes around and does respect Christine, especially. And of course, we get that final line where they ask, "Well, isn't he going to come after you now that he's escaped?" And she says, "No, he wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be professional courtesy to do something like that. It wouldn't be polite." So,
What's really interesting is that when we think about these Gothic novels as having been the foundation of what became the horror genre, people might have read Dracula, they might have read Frankenstein, but when we think of those characters today, the images that come to mind are all based on movie characters.
Oh, there's no question about that. That both the 1931 version of Dracula with Bela Lugosi and that same year of Frankenstein with Boris Karloff playing the monster, those images, that iconography is absolutely indelible. Even though especially the Lugosi Dracula is a very often parodied and lampooned figure that anybody can do that impression, basically. At the same time, versions of Dracula that somehow don't look like Bela Lugosi, don't sound like Bela Lugosi, we think of as being sort of daring or unusual and strange in some ways. The Frankenstein monster, that again, if you've read the book or many of the stage adaptations that were done before the film was made, the monster, number one, can speak. And on stage was usually costumed wearing like early 19th century clothing with lapels and large belt and knee boots and so on. And that just seems completely at odds with our image of that scarred, almost robotic, corpse-like figure that Karloff plays in Frankenstein.
And once again, Frankenstein sort of captures your sympathy for a while, or the monster does. You sort of feel for this thing that was created against its own will.
Yeah, and the monster is such an appealing character. Again, the famous story between Karloff and Lugosi is that after the success of Dracula, which was significant, Lugosi was originally going to play the monster in Frankenstein. They did actually shoot a brief test sequence with him and a version of the makeup. And Lugosi turned it down. And the famous line always attributed to him was to say that any half-wit extra could play this part. And Karloff went, "No, there's more than that
here."
Those
are famous last words in Hollywood, aren't they?
Famous last words, yeah. Any half-wit extra. But Karloff understood, and he worked very well with James Whale, that there absolutely were nuances to this character, even though he could not speak, unlike the character in the novel and the plays. And that it could be done, and even wearing heavy makeup, it could be done through facial expression, through careful control of body movements. In other words, doing all the things that actors do. The monster is like, in the James Whale Frankenstein, the monster is like a child, among other things, too. And that's another thing that makes him completely sympathetic and gave an actor like Karloff a lot to play.
Some of the really old horror films that terrified people in their day now seem sort of stilted to us, and we can laugh at them and think about Gene Wilder, you know, playing Dr. Frankenstein. But some sort of remain really creepy, and you write in the book about The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is still really an unsettling thing to watch, even though in some ways it's ridiculous with the long fingernails and, you know, the drama.
Mm-hmm. Well, both The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and then the other film that came out a year or two after that, Nosferatu, which was the first version of Dracula, they're both visually stunning films in terms of the production design and the makeup and the costuming. And I think that's what again, the performances as well, but those are images from films that we really take with us. And I think there's ways in which those films are in a sense, painterly. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean they do create these images through line and shadow and action and composition that are just really indelible.
You give a great screenshot from, I think it's Caligari, and you can clearly see that the German Expressionist art is a big part of the way the set was constructed.
Oh, it was completely that from the beginning. The three art directors who designed the film had all worked in or were familiar with the most avant-garde and modernist Expressionist stage work that was being done in the teens toward the end of the First World War in Germany. And it was their idea, actually, the production designers who read the script and came back to the director and the screenwriters and said, what if we did this in the style of these modernist paintings, which are so unworldly, so strange and unreal, and incorporate that into the story? And everyone agreed immediately that was a great idea. And the German Expressionist visual style really became central to what Hollywood is doing then about a decade or so later in the early 30s, just adopting that German style of the 20s to American movies.
Was there a greater respect for the genre during that time than there was later on when they became thought of as things that the teenagers would go see?
Yes. At least initially, Frankenstein and Dracula, The Black Cat, and other films that were done at some of the other major studios like Freaks and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde at Paramount, which was a terrific film. Those were A-budget films with major stars, essentially. Frederick March was starting to be a big star when he did Jekyll and Hyde. And they were prestige movies in the sense that these were movies that were going to be on par with the best productions of major studios in the first half of the 30s. By the early 1940s, that had really changed completely, and now these were really increasingly perceived as being essentially juvenile entertainment, that they were for, it was kid stuff, and it's for, and they were sort of highly emotional, melodramatic kind of stories that were not to be taken very seriously.
Freaks, for people who are not familiar with that, is a really interesting piece of work. They were actual people who were working for circuses and freak
yes.
shows, which they were called at the time, and they were cast in this film.
Yeah, Todd Browning, the director of that film, had actually worked in carnivals when he was young, and he had done this act in which he was actually buried alive in a coffin. He was below ground, but he was in a coffin that was open where you could look down and see him, and he would spend like a day or so buried underground. Which had to have been very strange and awful. But
it's like a Billy Bob Thornton thing now. You know?
But yeah, it seems to be one of the things. But he really had that kind of huckster daring. And so when he's coming up with this film of Freaks, and he used the carnival setting in a number of his different films, Carnival and Circus, he said, if we're really going to do this, let's go all the way. Let's don't put an actor in makeup. Let's get people who have essentially congenital birth defects and handicaps, and we will cast both mental and physical, and we will cast them in the film that's about these characters. And the brilliant part of that film is that he takes these figures and makes them sympathetic and makes them essentially the heroes of the movie. I mean, it just reverses the whole idea of what's the freak and what's the normal.
Yeah, you write that always the star of a horror film is the monster or the aggressor, even if we never can find a way to really empathize with that character.
In the more traditional horror films that really were made between the 30s and about the mid-60s, they always end in a particular way, which is that the monster is destroyed in a kind of way that permits a sense of catharsis, that it's over, that daylight has come, and we get a happy couple clutching and reunited at the end of the film. But even though that's telling us that everything is fine and good when the monster is destroyed and this couple is together, we're not interested in that couple ever. they're both upstanding and boring. They're both boring. We don't necessarily want to see the heroine harmed by the monster, but she's almost always attracted to him in different ways. So the monster is absolutely the center of interest and attention in all of the films. No one dresses as the stalwart hero. They dress as Frankenstein, Dracula, Freddy Krueger, etc.
We are talking to Rick Warland. He is a professor of cinema television at Southern Methodist University. His new book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. We'll talk more after this break and get you to call and let us know some of your favorite films. You can also ask a question. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Quite a good scene, isn't it? One man crazy, three very sane spectators.
Must be done on hallowed ground. A church. His blood must be spilled on the altar of God. This first knife is most important. It extinguishes physical life and forms the center of the cross.
These are knives. He wants me to stab him. He wants me to murder a child.
Well, it's not a child.
We are talking about horror films today with Rick Warland, who is professor of cinema television at Southern Methodist University. His book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. Of course, there you just heard scenes from Frankenstein and The Omen. I can hear people's Netflix cues being changed as we speak. You know, what's so interesting about both of those is that they're from very different eras, and they seem to speak to different ideas about what is sort of threatening and scary. But I guess it's too tempting maybe to make everything into an allegory for the fear of the day.
Well, I think, yes, I think that's true. And that's something that I was always mindful of. People have talked about the fact that the first really American Gothic horror boom occurred in the first half of the 1930s, which was during the worst period of the Great Depression. And I think there are suggestive connections between those two phenomena, but at the same time, there's almost no direct references to economic collapse and calamity within those films. However, I think it's interesting that the most famous statement that we remember from Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression was in his first inaugural address, in which he said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And so Roosevelt was trying to calm fears that were abstract, in a sense, that everything is going wrong, and perhaps the monsters, though, were a way of sort of dealing with that. In the case of The Omen in the 70s, there's no question that there is a kind of subgenre of the horror film that takes that begins with Rosemary's Baby in 1968. That's about the terrible child, the bad, frightening, dangerous child. And this is in The Exorcist, of course, which was a gigantic hit. The Omen, Rosemary's Baby, and a number of others.
Was that a response to people saying, "What happened to my sweet little baby boomer who turned into a hippie?" I mean,
I don't think that's too far off the mark. The great thing about really popular works of any particular type or genre is that they aren't just about one thing. They're about a number of different things in various ways and at the same time. But the history of the counterculture, one of the key events of the counterculture was the free speech movement at Berkeley in 1961 or 62, which later got dubbed the dirty speech movement. One of the most important things that happens in The Exorcist is not only that her head turns around backwards and she spews out green vomit and assaults herself with a crucifix, but that what she says while she's doing it. So she's using a whole string of obscene language. So I think in a sense that's part of it. And also what happens in The Exorcist, it's almost thrown away and it's kind of easy to miss. But when we first see Chris McNeil, the mother in The Exorcist, she's an actress and she's making a movie that's about campus protest. And that's just it's this little bracket that sets up the rest of the film. They never really refer to it again. But I think that was a way of just signaling this is exactly what this particular movie is about, at least at that level.
It's funny that particular clip that we used from Frankenstein, sounds very relevant today as we're talking about things like genetic manipulation and cloning and the ramifications of our ability to do these things when we might not know what comes of them. I mean, obviously it wasn't really an issue in the 30s, except maybe in the eugenics movement, but it wasn't specifically there. And clearly Mary Shelley wasn't aware that this would ever be possible. But I guess these things can take on different kinds of relevance as each generation reinterprets them.
I think it's, in the case of Frankenstein, it really has become this all-purpose metaphor of unintended consequences, of anything that we're trying to do something good and something awful that we didn't foresee comes about. But I think in the actual 1931 movie, this is a movie that's made about the industrial age, and that the monster in Frankenstein is more robot and machine-like as well as being a kind of animated cadaver. And that's why there's this really memorable effects of the bolts at the neck, which makes him something like a machine in addition to that. So I don't really think there's so much about cloning or genetics or whatever in the film, but I think there is this fear of the machine, of technology, of science getting beyond our control, and I think we're still plausibly and correctly afraid of those things.
The monster's at the door as we speak.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Rick Warland is here. His book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. Let's go to Ryan in Dallas. Hello, Ryan.
Yeah, hi. I'm Ryan. I'm calling from Dallas. And I had kind of a comment and a question. I noticed I was talking about horrors, mainly about fears. But a lot of the horror, I'm a big horror fanatic. A lot of the horror that I really like are such things like Night of the Living Dead and Hellraiser, whereas Night of the Living Dead seems to be more about racism, and Hellraiser seems to be more about the breakup of the family unit, the betrayal between the family, and the monsters coming in actually to save poor Kirsty. And I was wondering if you guys think that horror will be pushing in that direction in the future, considering that the collapse of the economy, world economy, might be a little more scary than the devil or vampire. I'll take my question off and my answer off the air.
Thanks, Ryan.
Well, that's interesting, and I think that to talk about that, those larger kind of macro social issues in relation to the horror genre is a point at which both science fiction and horror kind of bump up against each other. The general distinction that I would make between horror and science fiction, or as an observation, is that horror is about individual fears and problems, and science fiction tends to be about global, collective, very broad political and social problems, which is not to say that those two things aren't interconnected. Of course they are. I mean, if you go back to the idea of the haunted house, it's literally where we live. And what's one of the most pressing issues in the news about the economic problems? People losing their homes. So these things are always connected.
So you put Alien in the horror category?
Yeah, Alien is a terrific film in any category, really. But Alien is very much like the kind of slasher films in which the monster is this alien creature instead of a psychopath, essentially. And that's really one of the great films, and it's very frightening. There's no question.
Let's go next to Patrick in Fort Worth. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks.
I was wondering if you attribute the taking seriously of science fiction to that trend we were just speaking of science fiction going gothic with like John Carpenter's The Thing and Alien, where it's the isolation and almost like the castle, even if it's in space, and the monster in the castle type thing. I'm wondering if the movie Society and Academy starts taking those performances seriously because it harkens back to that earlier era. And I can take my answer off here as well. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, science fiction didn't become a viable Hollywood genre until the very early 1950s. And, of course, the major, almost cliche, although it's true, thing to say about those films is the two chief sources of fear in early science fiction of the 50s was alien invasion and atomic weapons. And so, again, it comes back to the idea that those were collective problems. I think that one of the reasons that science fiction took that form in the 50s is because in the aftermath of the tremendous death toll in World War II the Holocaust, and then the recognition that now we've got weapons that can literally destroy entire cities and destroy potentially much of the world, that this is now that these are absolutely collective fears that that involve everyone. I think you're right in touching on Alien and John Carpenter's version of The Thing, because especially both of those movies hark back to predecessors in the 50s.
So we've talked about the Gothic tradition of having this scary haunted castle or haunted house in the American version. Then you have a movie like The Shining, which is an interesting sort of departure and yet, I guess, a repetition of that tradition, except that it starts out in a place that looks completely normal at first. It looks like it could have been any movie, you know, of its day.
Yeah, and that's, again, Stanley Kubrick is a brilliantly innovative artist in the same way that Alfred Hitchcock was. And so what Stanley Kubrick did in his version of Stephen King's novel, which, by the way, Stephen King never liked very much, was to, again, as Hitchcock had done, go against conventions and go against expectations, that there's not much shadowy visual style in the Shining. It takes place in bright daylight, much of the film. It's in the mountain hotel where there's the snow reflection is making things even brighter. There's this kind of banal modern cleanliness to the hotel, and it's not like the guy's even been sent there to, like, clean things up, because he's just there to watch it in the winter. It's already beautiful and immaculate and ready for the next season.
But I guess that film really looks at our fear, not only of maybe madness, but of our own savagery.
Yeah, and it's very much focused, again, like the traditional Gothic novel, it's focused on that idea of the family breakdown, the monster being within a marriage, being a terrible father or a terrible husband in some way.
We have an email from Rod who asks if you consider the movie Jaws a horror movie.
Yeah, that's kind of a bone of contention with me. I think Jaws is a terrific movie by any estimation. There was a book written in the late 70s, a pretty good book on the horror film, that talked about Jaws as a horror film. And from that point on, it kept cropping up in references to the horror film. And I was determined in my book that I wasn't going to contribute to that, because I think Jaws is a terrific film. If you say, well, it's about fear, absolutely, it's there in Jaws. And it is a monster. There's no question that the shark is a monster. And there are suggestive ways of talking about it, but I don't really think people perceived it as a horror film.
Let's go next to Nathan in Dallas. Hello, Nathan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reference in your discussion earlier to the couple at the end of the movie who are upstanding and plain and uninteresting brought to mind a movie that's kind of an out on the edge, I guess, in the genre. And so I'd just like you to comment a little bit on productions like Rocky Horror Picture Show and Little Shop of Horrors, and I'll listen offline.
Thanks.
Well, those were both essentially very conscious parodies of the conventions of the horror film, and I think that sort of camp explosion of the horror film conventions is what's there in Rocky Horror, and that's the very thing, of course, that the original show and the movie then fixate on, which is let's take this boring couple, let's take Brad and Janet, and really express how dull we think they really truly are, and really make fun of them rather than trying to save them in some way in the story. The Little Shop of Horrors the original version was shot by Roger Corman in the late 50s and shot in just a few days. And it really plays like an almost slapstick burlesque of the horror film. There's a lot of kind of Borscht Belt humor in the movie, and then having the man-eating plant and so on. But I think most of the time these kind of parodies of the horror film are fairly respectful. I mean, it's really coming out of a tradition of we really like these movies, and we're so familiar with them, we're so familiar with the conventions that we're able to poke fun at them and not do so in a kind of destructive or condescending way.
Wasn't that Jack Nicholson's first film ever?
It was one of his first films. I think that's right. And he was working for the AIP at that time and working for Roger Corman. And he plays, of course, the sadomasochistic dental patient in that film. It's a completely, I think the great line is something like, there's just such a feeling of progress when that drill bites in.
That's a line for the ages. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Vicki's on the line now from Princeton. Hello, Vicki.
Hello. I would like to, actually I have two things. First, I'd like for him to comment on the films of Val Lewton, and particularly the Cat People. And considering that it was made in 1943, there seemed to be some zeitgeist issues there. And also, I had heard when I was in college in Denton back in the late 60s, so you can take that for what it's worth, that Todd Browning had at some time or other scouted locations in Decatur and wanted to use the exteriors of the Wagner Mansion for Dracula's Castle. And I was wondering if... anybody else had ever heard that?
I've never heard that. I'd never heard that connection before because I think Dracula was always pretty much going to be a studio production. And originally, and that which in Hollywood in the early 30s at the beginning of the sound period, that meant that it was going to be shot within studio walls for the most part. And actually, originally, Dracula was going to be a bigger scale movie than it was, but because of the Depression and Universal had to kind of scale back, and there's not a lot of, apart from Dracula's Castle itself, there are not a lot of extensive sets in the film. In the case of Val Lewton, he is absolutely, the producer Val Lewton, who worked at RKO in the early 40s, is absolutely one of the great masters of the horror film, some of the most influential movies made at the time, and they were very, very low-budget films, Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie and others of those. They were budgeted at about $150,000. To give you a comparison, right around that time, Orson Welles had made Citizen Kane at RKO for about $850,000, and Citizen Kane was not an extravagantly expensive movie. So Citizen Kane, $850,000, Cat People, $150,000. And so Val Lewton could not rely on extensive sets and props and costumes that he used. He used shadows and suggestion very, very effectively.
Rick Warland is here. He is a professor of cinema television at SMU. His new book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. We'll talk more to you after this break. If you want to get on the line to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
I'm speaking to the person inside of Reagan now. If you are there, you too are hypnotized. I must answer all my questions. Come forward and answer me now. Are you the person inside of Reagan? Who are you?
Close my eyes. I'm scared to open them. I'm gonna die out of here.
You heard heard a clip from The Exorcist first and then The Blair Witch Project for our discussion about films with Rick Warland. He is a professor of cinema television at SMU. His book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. Blair Witch was such an interesting film and a really scary one in a sort of Hitchcock way, in that we never really saw anything gory.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. I would have to say it's not among my favorite horror films, but I certainly respect both the idea and the execution. And it was very, very hard to pull off for contemporary audiences, pulled off a horror film that doesn't have a monster, that doesn't have a scare scene, a kind of monster attack scene of some kind or another, and to have kept the monster basically completely off screen the entire time and yet have made the film gripping. And I think it does work very well in that way.
And then a few years later, there was a sequel that was probably the worst movie ever.
Yeah, well, it was such a low budget thing. I think it originally cost something like $60,000 to make, and it was played in art houses originally, and then it went wide, of course, and it was a huge, huge success. So they had nothing to lose by trying two or three sequels. You know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Zach's on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
I actually took a class with Professor Warland a few years ago, quite enjoyed it. But I heard a report on NPR, a couple of years ago, saying that the trends in horror movies reflect people's feelings economically, that when they're feeling safe economically, that the trends in horror movies will be zombies or viral infections or things that come from within inside the human psyche, whereas when people are feeling panicked economically, it'll be something they can't control, like a slasher or the blob or a monster from outside. And I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
Interesting.
Well, I would say that within the horror genre, there's always two things happening at the same time. I think there is this level of immediate zeitgeist, this immediate sense of how we're feeling now about particular things. And I think that especially happens when there's very successful, highly, phenomenally popular films, whether it's The Exorcist or Blair Witch or something like that. But at the same time, I really think there are universal fears that are tapped in the horror film, things that never go away. I mean, death is a fact of life. I mean, it's an aspect that every one of us has to confront and deal with in some way or another. And so that's why the family, children, fear, monsters, death, that those are always perennials that always work.
It seems to happen often that in films where there are a number of victims and the protagonist is the sort of one standing that has to confront this, it's an interesting dynamic that we are set up to fear the confrontation as much as the death. The deaths go by very quickly and we don't really see them happening. But suddenly when there's that last scene where they're together, that's the really scary point.
Yeah, and I think that's where there's always a kind of balance between graphic horror and actual suspense. And suspense is built up. Suspense is worrying about what's going to happen, and that kind of anxiety. And it's almost there's actually a pretty nice line that in that montage clip that we listened to from The Blair Witch, where the woman says, "I'm afraid to close my eyes. I'm afraid to keep my eyes open." That there is no rest. But it's almost like you wish something would happen instead of just being afraid of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Susan in Royce City. Hey, Susan.
Hey, this is very interesting, and I especially like, the definitions Rick is giving on the, traditional gothic horror film as you start to think about some of the films that have chilled you in the past. And I wanted to ask you about The Honeymoon Killers. Are you familiar with that?
No, sorry, I'm not. I do know the title.
Well, I believe it was Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro early, and I just saw it on one of the stations one time. It was chilling. It was based on a true story, so in that view. But he was a monster and really under, in a human skin. He was a savage person. But, I was just wondering if the fact that it was based on a true story, if that would just, qualify it from being, or, a horror type.
No, not really. And I think that's where, again, the influence of Psycho was substantial. That Psycho really was actually Hitchcock doing a version of the low-budget exploitation-style horror films that were successful at the box office in the late 50s from AIP and Columbia. So films like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and The House on Haunted Hill and The Tingler and films like that. Hitchcock, who was very smart observer of the audience, looked at those films, and even though he had just made North by Northwest, which is a big blockbuster with Cary Grant, he said, I can do that. And so Hitchcock went out and made Psycho on a very low budget and really brought about those kind of lurid conventions, that brought out those lurid conventions of exploitation horror. But what he's also doing there to kind of, I think, to maybe address your question of why Psycho was so significant is because it did situate the monster in rather everyday, banal surroundings rather than the Frankenstein's laboratory or Castle Dracula.
What about Texas Chainsaw Massacre? That is a really, you'd think that all horror movies are sadistic, but this one, the characters get such a pleasure from really torturing people. It's different than other horror films where you're just slashing up bodies.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think that's certainly a valid response to that film, but I think the characters of the monster family, the cannibal family, are so bizarre and so out there that they're almost it's sometimes hard to feel they sort of identify what they're really after in a sense. I mean, do they treat, especially Sally in that long, long protracted sequence at the end, do they treat Sally as if she's a person or do they treat her as if she's a cow that they're going to slaughter? And it just moves back and forth between being slightly rational and completely irrational throughout the whole thing. And I think that's one of the most harrowing scenes in any horror film.
Do you ever sit there and think to yourself, who is writing this? And how do they go home at the end of the day and sit down at the dinner table?
The general pattern has been that people who do horror things tend to be very witty and funny and not at all sort of like creepy and introverted and things that like the characters. And I think it may come back to the idea of the artist, dealing with their own fears and problems in a much more positive and creative way.
Let's speak next to Shane in Dallas. Hi, Shane.
Hi. I wondered if your guest had read or if he had any comments regarding Michael Jones' book, Monsters from the Id, that, basically the thesis is that the rise of horror corresponds with Enlightenment and represents sort of the revenge of conscience in reaction to sexual liberty and unbridled passions, whether you'd either read that or had any comments with regard to that. Thanks.
I haven't read that book, but that from what you've just briefly described, that seems very much in the current of thought of a lot of the history of the thought about Gothic horror. And especially in the 20th century, it just became axiomatic to assume, because of the great, great impact of Freudian psychoanalytic theory, just to assume that horror films were all really Freudian in some basic level. And I think one of the ways that contributed to that was Freud's most popular and accessible work was The Interpretation of Dreams, and in which Freud essentially says that all of our dreams are coded narratives that are really a kind of form of self-communication that are about our own individual problems and fears. And, we get those images in nightmares of I'm in my house, but there is something after me, or I'm trying to get away, or something horrible, something that I don't want, something embarrassing is occurring to me. So I think there's no question that at least because of the great, great power of Freudian psychoanalytic theory, especially even in a popularized way, that it's just inevitable that we think of the films in that way.
Are there really cautionary tales in the same way that, say, a fairy tale would be? Because sometimes in a horror movie, you don't really know why the victim is the victim or why this person is being suddenly targeted by whatever the monster is.
No, that's a good point. And I think horror films work very much going back and forth between a kind of rational explanation for this and complete irrationality. We do know, for example, that just in terms of crime statistics, that although there's street crime every day and children are sadly kidnapped off the street by strangers, the overwhelming statistical reality is that if you're going to be a victim of violence, it'll be by someone you know, not a total stranger. So those fears are both rational and irrational in that sense.
Let's go next to Bill in Plano. Hi, Bill.
Hi. What I want to know, in your opinion, what the worst horror film ever made was.
That's a good question.
Oh boy, there's so many fine contenders for that possibility. I guess the stock answer would be to say, well, it's got to be Plan 9 from Outer Space, but by Edward D. Wood. But of course, if people who really like Ed Wood, and I'm one of them, just absolutely love that film and love his work because it's so completely idiosyncratic and individualistic. And is it bad? Well, yeah, but it's probably crossed over into it's so bad it's good. I tend to think actually that more higher budget films, which tend to be more safe and traditional, are bigger disappointments to me than many of the let it all hang out exploitation films. And I think because when big budgets are at stake, a real kind of caution and conservative filmmaking and comes into play. And so generally speaking, I can't think of one right off the top of my head, but generally speaking, sort of glossier horror films to me are far less interesting than the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Do you have a favorite bad line? You know, like Soylent Green is people.
Oh, again, you know, there's a lot of potential contenders for that. I don't have one at the top of my head. Sorry.
Well, can you talk for a minute about you know, if you were teaching a class of, you know, 18 to 20 year olds, what the canon would be, what the five or six films that they would have to see to understand the genre would be?
Oh, well, when I teach the genre, yeah, I usually do Frankenstein for the classic horror films of the 30s and 40s, which really established the genre. One of the callers mentioned Cat People, which I think is a wonderful film, also because of the way it uses the horror of suggestion. Psycho, because it's a very important transitional film. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which we've mentioned. Night of the Living Dead, also a seminal movie in different ways. So those are among them, anyway.
Do you still have to make these a guilty pleasure? Can you admit now that you're a college professor and this is a part of your academic field that you enjoy this?
Oh, no, I don't have a problem with it at all. I mean, I never did. Because I think horror movies, especially when you're a kid, I think kids like horror movies. And they've been the central audience for horror for 50 years, since the late 50s. And not at all. And I do find my taste changing a little bit. I'm less interested in the really more graphic horror films of recent vintage, the so-called torture porn films that came out after Saw. And I will say that I like the first Saw film, which is the only one I've ever seen, because it's visually very interesting, and there's a lot of attention to sets and style and lighting and shadows, and I give it a lot of credit for that.
What's the last movie that really scared you and took you by surprise?
Oh, well, that's a good question.
Beyond maybe Enron, the smartest guy in the room.
The last horror film that I saw that I thought was really... Oh, well, it's been a while back. It's like more than 20 years, but which is not to say there hasn't been good things since then. But one film that I really love and I wrote about in the book is Stuart Gordon's film Reanimator, which has one of the most extraordinary sequences ever committed to film. And everyone who's seen it knows what I'm talking about.
Okay. So we'll hope that everybody, again, gets on Netflix and finds things out. Do you watch a scary movie on Halloween?
Oh, yeah, usually. Yeah.
Rick Warland is a professor of cinema television at SMU. His new book is called The Horror Film, An Introduction. Rick, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris. It was fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a spooky day.